Exodus chapter 4, verses 27 to chapter 5, verse 23. The ninth talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on December 6, 2015 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 9, Exodus 4:27 to 5:23, accompanies this talk.
We're going to look at Exodus, starting chapter 4, verse 27, where we left off. Just to bring you up to date on what's going on in Exodus, if you'll recall, God had made a promise a half a millennium earlier. He had told Abraham that his descendants would be taken to another land where they would be enslaved, and that after 400 years, God was going to bring Abraham's people out of that land and return them to the land that God had given to Abraham. And we see in the beginning of Exodus that God has listened to his people. He has heard their cries, and now he's going to respond. And a baby is born, Moses is born, who has a unique situation. He is the son of two Levite parents, and he is adopted by the daughter of Pharaoh and raised in Pharaoh's household. So he's in this unique position to be able to do something to help his people, and I'm convinced that he reached the conclusion that he was uniquely suited to do that, perform that kind of service, and that he was going to be the one to help relieve the suffering of his people. But when he grew up and began to take action on behalf of his people, they rejected his leadership. And Moses was forced to flee Egypt and was very hurt by what had happened. Goes into the desert where he spends 40 years. He got married there and he herded the flocks of his father-in-law. But after 40 years, God appears in a bush to Moses and says, I'm going to take action now. I'm going to lead the people of Israel out of Egypt, and you're the one that's going to do this. And Moses at this point is thinking, no way. I thought that was what I was going to do 40 years ago, and that didn't work out well, and I'm not going back. But God persuades him. They have a lengthy conversation, and all of the concerns that Moses brings up, God addresses, and Moses is persuaded to take on the assignment that God has given to him. So Moses gets all ready and begins the process of leaving Midian, leaving Sinai, and beginning the trek back to Egypt to do what God had told him to do. But then, as we saw last week, he comes down with a fatal illness of some sort that God has afflicted him with. And his wife then circumcises their firstborn and takes the foreskin and touches it to Moses' feet. And Moses recovers. And I think that the significance of that is that Moses, he and his family had to fully identify with the Israelites, which they had not done, this is the way I'm reading it, because of the hurt that he felt from being rejected by his own people when he went to help them. But at this point now, Moses is fully identifying with his people, and he is setting out to head back for Egypt. So he's still in the desert when we pick up the action at the end of chapter 4, verse 27. Now the Lord said to Aaron, go to meet Moses in the wilderness. So he went and met him at the mountain of God and kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord with which he had sent him, and all the signs that he had commanded him to do. Then Moses and Aaron went and assembled all the elders of the sons of Israel, and Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. He then performed the signs in the sight of the people. So the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel, and that he had seen their affliction, then they bowed low and worshiped. So Aaron, as God had said he would do, God had said that he would send Aaron to meet Moses. God spoke to Aaron, and Aaron starts hiking out into the desert to find Moses. I have all kinds of questions about this. How did God communicate this to Aaron? How did Aaron get out of Egypt? They're enslaved in Egypt. Is he so old that they don't care whether he leaves or what's going on? Is there bad border security? I don't know. And then, how's he find Moses? Did they communicate for 40 years? Was there any communication that took place for 40 years? And does he know where Moses is? And they didn't have cell phones. How did they find each other out in the middle of the desert? And I don't know the answers of any of those questions. In any case, Aaron goes out and he finds Moses, and he finds him at the mountain of God. He finds him at Mount Sinai. So this is a location where a lot of significant things are happening, and there are more significant things that will happen there. Aaron locates Moses and kisses him. My suspicion is that that is a really joyous meeting, that Aaron would love to know what has happened to Moses over the last 40 years, and Moses would love to know what has happened to his family back in Egypt for the last 40 years. So I'm sure that they had lots to talk about. In addition to exchanging that kind of news, Moses brings Aaron up to date with respect to all that God has said to Moses and what God has up his sleeve, and what role Moses is going to play in that, and what role Aaron is going to play in that. So Moses, I'm sure, told him all of that stuff, and also told him about the signs that God had performed and that they will be performing when they get back to Israel. Now, Aaron has been, to a certain extent, prepared for the news that he receives from Moses. God spoke to Aaron, and God told Aaron, go out and meet Moses. So Aaron's got to know that something's going on. So it shouldn't be a complete surprise to him when Moses tells him what he tells him. That is, when Moses tells him what God has said. But furthermore, I suspect that in Egypt at this time, among the Israelites, that there is a certain amount of expectation. And I think that that's probably the case for two reasons. One is, a pharaoh has died, and as I mentioned before, pardons were typically handed out when a new pharaoh came to the throne. And in any case, there were major changes that would take place when a new pharaoh comes to the throne, replacing the old pharaoh. That was typically a time when there were major changes in policy. So I suspect that the Israelites are thinking maybe something will happen now. The other reason is, as God had said to Abraham, that his people would be in a foreign land and be enslaved for 400 years. If they remember that at all, somebody's got to be counting. And if somebody's counting, they know that the time is about now. So it would not surprise me if Aaron left an environment in which there was a certain amount of expectation that something big was going to happen and their situation was going to improve. Moses and Aaron then return to Egypt. They gather together the elders and they do as they were told by God. They tell the elders what God had told them, and they demonstrate the three signs for them, for the elders. And I think it's probably the elders and the people were probably all witnesses of what Moses and Aaron said. Do note that the one who does the talking here, in verse 30, and Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. So just as God had said that Aaron would be the spokesman, Aaron is the one who does the talking when they're talking to the elders. And as I've pointed out before, that seems to have been the greater concern for Moses. He was less concerned about talking to Pharaoh than he was talking to his own people. It says, then, after they've done this, that the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, then they bowed low and they worshiped. So I think it is the case that after Moses and Aaron have presented all of this material and the signs, people are looking at that and they believe. But I think that, first of all, that's great news. What Moses and Aaron are telling them is just the kind of thing they want to hear. They want to hear that they're going to be freed, and that's the message that Moses and Aaron have brought. They have presented three impressive signs that were likely to catch their attention. And this is going to require something of them, at least potentially, and that is, if they go along with Moses and Aaron, there is a sense in which they become rebels against the Pharaoh. So there is some cost involved here, and they have to know that that would be the case. But I think that the belief that it's talking about here is not the kind of enduring, life-changing faith that we see elsewhere. I think what this means is that at the time when the people saw the signs and heard what Aaron and Moses said, they're thinking, yeah, that's about right. Yeah, so it's about time. I like this. We're for it. Those signs, yep, this is compelling. We believe this is going to happen. But that is an untested kind of belief that I think is not enduring. And I think as we go through Exodus, it becomes clear that it's not that kind of enduring faith that can stand the test of time. And it's helpful, I think, to recognize that because I suspect that the term believe, as we see it in the Gospels, is sometimes of this nature. The untested kind of momentary, yeah, that sounds right, kind of belief that will not stand the test of time. Okay, at this point, Moses has to be encouraged. Everything is going according to plan. And the people of Israel have responded positively, and that's the thing that he was most worried about. Okay, chapter 5, the first 9 verses. And afterward, Moses and Aaron came and said to Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness." But Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and besides, I will not let Israel go." Then they said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword." But the king of Egypt said to them, "Moses and Aaron, why do you draw the people away from their work? Get back to your labors." Again, Pharaoh said, "Look, the people of the land are now many, and you would have them cease from their labors." So the same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters over the people and their foremen, saying, "You are no longer to give the people straw to make brick as previously. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the quota of bricks which they were making previously, you shall impose on them. You are not to reduce any of it, because they are lazy. Therefore they cry out, 'Let us go and sacrifice to our God. Let the labor be heavier on the men, and let them work at it, that they may pay no attention to false words.'" So Moses and Aaron do as they were told. They go to the Pharaoh, and they speak to him. And what they say is, and it's interesting, they say, "Thus says the Lord." That's the first time that a spokesman for God uses that phrase in the Old Testament. And then that's the phrase that you hear out of the mouths of prophets all the rest of the way through. So here is the first prophetic statement. Then he refers to God as the God of Israel. "Thus says the Lord," there it's Yahweh, "the God of Israel." I suspect that Pharaoh genuinely doesn't recognize that title, that term. I don't know that for sure, but that's my suspicion. And what he asks is that the people be allowed to celebrate a feast in the wilderness. And that's all that it says initially. Pharaoh responds, and the Pharaoh's response is probably harsher than they expected. Pharaoh says, who is the Lord? So that's Yahweh. Who is Yahweh that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? So he's questioning, who is this God that you say is needs to be worshipped? And this is Pharaoh. He's the king of the mightiest country in the world at the time, probably, and a god himself. And he's got lots of evidence to show that he and his divine ties are powerful. Okay. I jumped ahead of myself just a little bit. Let me talk a little bit more. There are a couple other things I want to say about Moses' request. As we saw earlier, this seems to be a reduced request from what is ultimately going to be asked of Pharaoh. What is ultimately going to be asked of Pharaoh is to let go of his people permanently. This request is just be allowed to go out into the wilderness to celebrate a feast, which is similar to what God had said that Moses was supposed to ask Pharaoh. And I think that this is just a reduced request. The larger request will come later, but Pharaoh will even turn down this lesser request. Now, let's look back at what God had said that Moses was to say to Pharaoh in chapter 3, verse 18. It says here, and they will, this is the Israelites, will pay heed to you, to what you say, and you, with the elders of Israel, will come to the king of Egypt, and you will say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. So now please let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Notice that this is different from what they came to Pharaoh and said in several different respects. Here it's the Lord, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews instead of the God of Israel. And it says that they are to go into the wilderness to make sacrifice. What Moses and Aaron said here was, let my people go that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness. There are some commentators that make a big deal of this because it is my observation generally in the Old Testament that if God says X and then that is passed on in a way that it's not exactly X, that there's a problem there. That those speeches need to be word for word perfect. And so some commentators see this as disobedience on the part of Aaron and Moses. The fact that they vary what God had told them to say to Pharaoh, they see as indicative of disobedience. I am a little reluctant to go that far, but my suspicion is that they went in thinking, this is going to go well. We've just told the elders and the people of Israel what we were supposed to tell them. They responded positively. God seems to be making things work the way they should. And I think that they were thinking that Pharaoh is going to respond in a way that will further this process along. He will respond relatively positively. Now, we know that they were warned, Moses was warned, that Pharaoh's heart would be hardened. So he knows there's going to be some resistance, but I don't think that he expected this much resistance. So Pharaoh's response then is quite harsh. Who's God that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I don't know him, and besides, I'm not letting him go. His response is extremely harsh. And it's interesting, he doesn't ask for any clarifying information or details or anything like that. This is not being negotiated. Pharaoh is saying, no, no way. It's not going to happen. So Moses and Aaron then respond what they say next. So it's a second try at making this request. This second try matches the wording in chapter 3 much more closely. They say, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. So here it's much more similar to the wording that was in chapter 3. And the first one was stated as a command. This one is stated as a request with a please. which is the wording that God had said in chapter 3. So I think what's happened is they went in overconfident. They asked to be allowed to go. Pharaoh came back very harshly. So now they do a second try, and this one is not as confrontive. Then they add, in any case, they go on to add, lest he, that is God, fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. That was not mentioned by God before. That's just thrown in here on top of what God had said. It is interesting that at this point, there have been no threats from God to Pharaoh. It's just a request, let my people go. And the only threat here is what would happen to the people of Israel, which, if that happens, then Pharaoh would suffer. He would lose his slave labor. Okay. Pharaoh then responds to what Moses and Aaron have said, and this response is even harsher than the one before. It says here in verse 4, but the king of Egypt said to them, I pointed out in chapter 1, it just talks about the Pharaoh just refers to him as the king, and later the king of Egypt, but it doesn't refer to him as Pharaoh there. And here it's the king of Egypt that is the title that's used. And I think that's significant. I've suggested a significance. I'm not sure that it's correct, but nevertheless, I just want to note that I'm sure that the wording here is significant. And then when Pharaoh speaks, he says, and he uses the names, Moses and Aaron, making this very personal. Moses and Aaron, why do you draw the people away from their work? This is interesting in that there is a sense in which there's kind of a duel going on between God and Pharaoh. And when God spoke to Moses in the burning bush, he called him out by name, Moses, Moses, take off your shoes. The ground you're standing on is holy ground. So there it was very personal. Here, the Pharaoh's getting very personal. Moses and Aaron, calling them out by name. And I think there's a reason for that. He's holding them personally responsible for what's happening here. Are you sure you are on the hook for this? You will be held responsible for this. Why do you draw the people away from their work? The word for draw here in Hebrew sounds almost identical to the word Pharaoh. So in other words, why are you pharaohing the people away from their work? And I suspect that's a play on words, that they are demanding the people's allegiance, their obedience, and it's the Pharaoh who is their Lord, and they are, Moses and Aaron are usurping his authority. He says, get back to your labors, get back to your work. That's the solution. That's what has to happen. And then in verse 5 it says, and again Pharaoh said, and Umberto Casuto makes an interesting comment with respect to this construction. If someone says something, and then it is followed by, again that person said, that the second thing said is explanatory of what was intended in the first thing. Have you followed me? If that's true, then, in verse 5, and Pharaoh said, what follows is explanatory. This is what the Pharaoh really intended to say. And that is, look, the people of the land are now many, and you would have them cease from their labors. That's been the problem in Pharaoh's mind all along, is there are a lot of these Hebrews. Something has to be done to make sure that they don't become a problem and undermine our power in Egypt. And the labor is the solution to that problem, and you are trying to pull them away from that. And that can't happen. So, the Pharaoh's solution is a new policy, a new decree that is issued. And his new decree is, from now on, you have to make the same number of bricks, but you have to gather the straw yourselves. The straw is used to reinforce the bricks. And so now, if they have to make that many bricks and gather the straw, that is probably doubling their labor. It's twice as much work that they have to do per day in order to keep up the same quotas on the brick making. And interestingly, there's a sense in which this is hurting Pharaoh. I mean, he's going to get fewer bricks made now. There's going to be less production. But Pharaoh wants to really impress upon them how they have to obey him and do what he says, or they are going to be in a whole bunch of trouble. So they go out and they gather stubble. They can't find enough straw, so they're finding stubble to use in the bricks and are having trouble keeping up with the quotas. Oh, Pharaoh says it's because they are lazy. That's why they're crying out. That's why they say, let us go sacrifice to our God. It's not because they've actually been told, commanded to do so by their God. It's because they're lazy. I find this interesting because Pharaoh thinks that he understands the nature of the problem. He thinks he knows why Moses and Aaron are asking to take the people out of Egypt. But the fact is, he doesn't. He's jumping to conclusions. And that's going to get him into trouble, because since he doesn't understand why they want to do what they want to do, he's going to address it wrongly. And then the last part of verse 9, let the labor be heavier on the men, and let them work at it, that they may pay no attention to false words. So they are, the people of Israel are put in a situation where they have to decide what are the true words and what are the false words. Moses says, follow me, I'm leading you out of slavery in Egypt. And Moses says, I was sent by God to do this, and here are some signs to prove that that is the case. That's what he's got going for him. Pharaoh says, look around. Who's in control? All of the facts on the ground say that I am in control, and that whatever God you're talking about, I dominate him. So Pharaoh says he doesn't want them to pay attention to false words. Next section. So the taskmasters of the people and their foremen went out and spoke to the people, saying, thus says Pharaoh, I am not going to give you any straw. You go and get straw for yourselves, wherever you can find it, but none of your labor will be reduced. So the people scattered through all the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw. And the taskmasters pressed them, saying, complete your work quota, your daily amount, just as when you had straw. Moreover, the foremen of the sons of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmaster had set over them, were beaten and were asked, why have you not completed your required amount either yesterday or today in making brick as previously? So Pharaoh is not going to relent whatsoever. They have to keep the quotas. They're sent out to do the same amount of bricks and find the straw themselves. They go all over looking for straw. They end up gathering stubble instead of straw, and still they can't keep up with the quotas. As a result, then, the foremen are taken and they are beaten, and they are asked, why have you not completed your required amount either yesterday or today in making brick as previously? So apparently what the system that Pharaoh has set up is Pharaoh issues his commands to the taskmasters, who presumably are Egyptian. And the taskmasters then relay that information to the foremen, who are directly responsible for making sure that those things are carried out in the workplace. And those foremen, it would appear, are Israelites. So there is advantage that is gained by having Israelites as the foremen, because there's a sense in which they're their own people. So if the foremen are rough on their people, well, it's Hebrews beating up on Hebrews. Those foremen who are Hebrews, they are, in exchange for their loyalty in carrying out the commands of the taskmasters and ultimately of Pharaoh, they get a privileged position in all likelihood. And they want dearly to hold on to that privileged position, and so they are ruthless in making sure that Pharaoh's commands are carried out. This is the same phenomenon that occurred in the prison camps and death camps in Nazi Germany. That early on, for instance, it was recognized, and this is at Auschwitz, that they had SS soldiers be the ones who killed Jews. But there were so many psychological problems that were created by that they decided that's not working well, so they used Jews as foremen. They gave them huge privileges for that position, but used them as the ones who were directly responsible for taking the action that put to death their fellow Jews. And that same thing was used with respect to work as well. So I just think that's fascinating that that structure would be repeated in the time of the Holocaust from the one that was used in Egypt. In any case, what Pharaoh's doing here, since they are not fulfilling their quotas, Pharaoh has these Israelite foremen flogged. Well, they're thinking, why am I being flogged? I have done nothing disloyal. I've been doing the best I can to carry out the commands of Pharaoh. And there's got to be some mistake here. There's got to be something wrong because this shouldn't be happening. And that brings us to the next section. Then the foreman of the sons of Israel came and cried out to Pharaoh, saying, "Why do you deal this way with your servants? There is no straw given to your servants, yet they keep saying to us, 'Make bricks.' And behold, your servants are being beaten, but it is the fault of your own people." But he said, "You are lazy, very lazy. Therefore you say, 'Let us go and sacrifice to the Lord.' So go now and work, for you shall be given no straw, yet you must deliver the quota of bricks." And the foreman of the sons of Israel saw that they were in trouble because they were told, "You must not reduce your daily amount of bricks." When they left Pharaoh's presence, they met Moses and Aaron as they were waiting for them. And they said to them, "May the Lord look upon you and judge you, for you have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us." So the foremen go to the Pharaoh, and they use this word several times, "your servants." So they're stressing their loyalty to Pharaoh. "We have been faithful to you. We have done what we've been asked. There has been nothing that has changed our loyalty to you and doing what we're asked to do. But what you've asked can't be done. So there's got to be some mistake somewhere." And they say, "Behold, your servants are being beaten, but it is the fault of your own people." He doesn't blame Pharaoh. They're thinking there's got to be a mistake somewhere. If Pharaoh only understands the situation, he'll change it. There's something got garbled in the communication that got passed down from Pharaoh. And that's why this is happening. That seems to be the attitude that they have and the approach that they take. But Pharaoh dispels that immediately. "No, you're lazy. You're very lazy. That's why this is happening." So Pharaoh thinks that he's got this all figured out. He understands why he's getting this resistance, and it's their laziness. So Pharaoh says, "Nothing's going to change. You have to meet your quotas." So the foremen, they leave their session with Pharaoh, and they've got to be extremely distressed because their positions of privilege are at jeopardy here. They're going to suffer, and it's not because they've been disloyal. It's because they've been asked to do something that's impossible, and they've been asked to do something impossible because of what Moses had done. Moses had gone and spoken to Pharaoh and made the request that they be allowed to leave. So as they go out, it says they met Moses and Aaron. That could be translated, "they fell upon." They fell upon Moses and Aaron as they, I think the "they" there is Moses and Aaron were waiting for them, but it's ambiguous. It could be that the foremen were waiting for Moses and Aaron. In any case, there is an encounter between the foremen and Moses and Aaron, and the foremen are furious. And they say to Moses and Aaron, "May the Lord, may Yahweh look upon you and judge you." So they're calling God to judge them for the wickedness that they have done, clearly not believing that Moses and Aaron are acting on God's command. "You have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand, kill us." Interestingly, and this comes back to the question that Ron asked last week, that there are two words that are repeated in chapter 5, words that appear when Moses is talking about what God said that they were supposed to tell Pharaoh, and here when the foremen are speaking to Moses and Aaron. And those two words are "to fall upon" and "sword." And what it says in verse 3 is, "Please let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. So here, what's being said is, if we don't do what we're told to do, God will fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. What is being countered with that here is the foreman's statement. The foreman fell upon Moses and Aaron, and they say, "You have put the sword into Pharaoh's hands." And I think that those words are repeated in order to highlight the contrast between these two. That the fall upon that is used in the first case is used to express how God would confront the Israelites. In the second case, it's how the foremen who are representing Pharaoh confronted Moses and Aaron, who are representing Yahweh. And the sword is used to describe the fate that the Israelites would have at the hands of God if they don't go and worship him. In the second case, it's the fate they are being threatened with by Pharaoh if they don't go to work. So I think it's contrasting the two fates, and I think that that contrast is being highlighted by the fact that those two words are repeated. Okay, so this is, if you put yourself in Moses' shoes, this is Moses' worst nightmare. Because he was reluctant to go and do what God had told him to do in the first place. But now he goes, and things look like they're going well at first. The elders respond well, the Israelites respond well. Then they go to see Pharaoh, and he doesn't respond as well. And Pharaoh makes life miserable, even more miserable for the Israelites. The foremen go to get the problem addressed, and the foremen come out with bad news. Pharaoh isn't changing his mind one bit, and you, Moses, are responsible for this. Moses has gone to be their savior and has made life more miserable for them than it had been before. And Moses, who has been worried about the Israelites responding to his leadership, is now put in a situation where his position of leadership will be extremely tested as a result of what's happening. A person's leadership always goes relatively well when things are going well. It's when things go badly that that relationship gets questioned. So Moses then turns to God with a very honest appeal. Verse 22, "Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, 'O Lord, why hast thou brought harm to this people? Why didst thou ever send me? Ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak in thy name, he has done harm to this people, and thou hast not delivered thy people at all.'" Wonderful, wonderful prayer on his part. I mean, you can feel the anguish. "I came to save them, and things have just gotten worse. Why are you doing this? Why did you bring me just to do harm to the people? And why did you send me in the first place? This is what I feared and more." Here we see Moses performing the role of a prophet. He's entering into the anguish of his people and appealing to God. And he is, in many respects, the premier prophet of the Old Testament. And in the next chapter, God is going to respond. And that will be the beginning of the process in which God is going to turn things around and start making things better for the people of Israel and bring about the salvation that he has promised. There's a phrase that C.S. Lewis uses in the Narnia Chronicles, talking about Aslan, in which he says, "Aslan is not a tame lion." I'm sure you're all familiar with that phrase. It's a wonderful phrase. And that is so true of God. God is not a tame God. And if you think back at the material that we've covered in the last couple chapters, Moses is being put through the ringer. God talks to him in the bush, and Moses doesn't want to go, and God persuades him to go. And you can sense that Moses is thinking, yeah, I got to do this thing, and this is a good thing that I will be doing, and it will help my people. But then he's afflicted with a deadly disease. Unbelievable that God would do that as the next thing. So now Moses has to be asking, what is going on? Why would this happen? But he's healed. He's rejoined with his brother. He makes his way back to Egypt. He speaks to the elders. Everything goes well. They believed. They accepted his leadership. He goes to speak to Pharaoh. Pharaoh is not going to let them go. In fact, Pharaoh makes things worse. And the people are suffering. They're trying to make these huge quotas, and they can't possibly make them. And as a result, as before, the Israelites, in the form of the foremen, They hold Moses personally responsible for doing this evil that's happening to the people of Israel. It makes no sense. Moses has got to be scratching his head trying to figure out what's going on here. Wasn't I asked to do this? And if I was asked to do this, aren't you going to help me, God? Aren't you going to do what you said you were going to do? And that's essentially the spirit that's behind the prayer that he makes. And God does respond, and it is going to turn around. But only after Moses has really been put through the ringer, and we'll see, he's not done being put through the ringer. We got a lot more of Exodus to go. God is not a tame lion, and it really helps to keep that in mind when we're trying to figure out why is he doing what he's doing when he does it. In many respects, it makes no sense. But he is fulfilling the promises that he made. He's just doing it in his way and in his time. And we're in the situation that the Israelites were in. We have to decide, what are the false words? Is it the world around us that's telling us the way reality really is? Or is it God and his word and his promises? Does that describe the way things really are? Who's saying the false words? And in the midst of the turmoil, it's hard to keep that in perspective. It's hard to remember why it is that we believe that God is in control and is doing what he says he will do. Okay, that's all I have. Questions?
Thank you, David. Mm-hmm. This question is both somewhat trivial and possibly not answerable at this time. So as a lot of people know, when the translators represent the word that's God's proper name that we say as Yahweh, they capitalize the letters. Mm-hmm. In verse 22, in my Bible, the first occurrence of the word is capitalized. Mm-hmm. And the second one that Moses uses to address Yahweh is not. And so I'm just wondering if those are really two different words.
I believe they are. I could get it on my phone, but it would take me a little while.
No, don't worry about it.
I'm assuming they didn't make a mistake. So if they didn't make a mistake, what's happening here is the first occurrence is indeed Yahweh, his name. But then when Moses speaks, it's, O Lord, that is, O Master, would be the idea. And I assume that's what it is, which would be interesting because that would be quite a contrast with the foreman.
Thank you.
Because the foreman are servants to Pharaoh. And if that's what the meaning is here, then it would be Moses is acknowledging God as his master. He's a servant to God.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, the Egyptian that Moses killed, mm-hmm. I was wondering if he was one of the taskmasters.
It doesn't specify. That wouldn't surprise me. I would assume that it's someone who's dealing directly with the Israelites as slaves, and that would be the most likely candidate.
And then I wonder if the Hebrew who rejected Moses at the beginning was a foreman.
Yeah, it could very well be. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but that could very well be.
It would make sense, yeah. Particularly, I think, because the foreman who got saved when the Egyptian got slain, he sounds like he'd be likely to tell his brother foremans, be like, oh, mm-hmm. Moses killed this guy.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that could be.
And that foreman would probably, I imagine that as a foreman, you could have a really good relationship with the people that you boss around, but could also have a really bad one and maybe feel more akin to the Egyptians.
Yeah. But even if that is the case, that it was a foreman, Moses took what was said by that person as being indicative of the people of Israel as a whole with respect to their relationship to him as a leader. And I think we are to see it that way. It's not a complete aberration. It's consistent with the character of the people of Israel.
The other thing I was thinking about is, I believe the first time they come to Pharaoh, it says all the elders came to.
That's not clear. In chapter 3, it says that he is supposed to go with the elders to speak to Pharaoh. That is not explicit in chapter 5, but I'm assuming that they were there. We just have an abbreviated account.
So I'm going to do a little bit of speculation here. Aaron was able to leave and cross the Sinai because he was old and he wasn't much good for work. And then all these old men come before Pharaoh and they're like, hey, let us go so we can do our stuff. And Pharaoh's like, I see all these men stirring up, all these old men stirring up trouble. And so I'm going to assign more work and the kind of work that old men can do. I'll say, all right, you guys have to do the same amount of work. And I wonder if the old men are out there scrapping up the stubble to help their people do stuff. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Possible. Okay.
Do we know what these bricks were being used for?
They're being used to build the cities, these storage cities.
Buildings within the city. pyramids or anything? Just
buildings. No, buildings. This is out in the East Delta region. The time of building pyramids was much earlier. They're building these storage cities, which have been excavated. They are made of brick, like it's being described in here. And in fact, as I understand it, there have been areas where the bricks don't have straw in them, which is a curious little thing, but yeah.
The other comparison you didn't make is Pharaoh held Moses personally responsible for causing trouble, mm-hmm. just like the foreman held Moses personally responsible.
Yes, yes. There's this duel going on between God and Pharaoh, or the powers that be in Egypt, and they are competing in various ways throughout this section. Okay,